Welcome to the Mindfulness Podcast. This is David Black. My guest today is Dr. Alyssa Kozlov. She's an instructor at Rutgers University School of Public Health and a licensed clinical psychologist. Her research focuses on improving geriatric mental health care and on the palliative care needs of older adults. Welcome, Dr. Kozlov. I read your new peer-reviewed article. It's published in the journal Clinical Gerontologist. You used a qualitative interview approach to understand how caregivers use and perceive a mobile intervention. The study aim was to identify barriers to using an app-based mindfulness meditation program in caregivers, and these caregivers are taking care of older adults who have cognitive impairment. I would love to know, so what we have in the field about an understanding of caregivers and their special needs, why are apps an important medium, you think, for this group?
So the caregiver population, well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you.
The caregiver population, I think, is one of the most underserved populations. They're often referred to as the hidden patients because they go to all these medical appointments, but they're never the subject of the medical appointments. And they often are neglecting their own health and mental health in order to care for their loved ones or their maybe less than loved ones. I think there's a big emphasis right now on how do we help the caregivers. Caregiving is an incredibly demanding, resource intensive, sometimes burdensome, sometimes a labor of love. But it's a really challenging role. And a lot of times the caregivers are themselves neglected. And so when we think about the mental health of caregivers, especially caregivers of older adults with cognitive impairment, we know that this population is really at risk for developing anxiety, burnout, depression, insomnia, all of these adverse mental health outcomes. And usually we would say, okay, like, well, we have great mental health treatments, you know, go see a social worker or a psychologist, go for face-to-face psychotherapy for an hour once a week. But that is, I think, an incredibly unrealistic treatment modality for a group of people who are already so time-strapped, so resource-strapped. And so I think we really have to think towards innovative ways to deliver efficacious mental health interventions where we can meet the caregivers where they are, you know, let them access the mental health intervention when it's convenient for them, not at a predetermined hour time slot that may or may not coincide with when their loved one is having, you know, a symptom flare up or when their loved one has an appointment. So I just think that we have to think kind of outside the box in terms of how to get mental health care to this really vulnerable population.
Yeah, adding more on the to-do list for a person and myself who's cared for others briefly, it hasn't been long-term at this point, but that having another thing on the to-do list and having to travel somewhere is not a great thing to have on that to-do list, especially when you're managing medications and other appointments and thinking about mental health of yourself, and that relationship usually comes last in line. So I fully get that. And you mentioned both in your paper, and as you were saying, that family usually members in the family will take on this responsibility probably most often if they have a family member who's an older adult and facing cognitive decline. So a family member, is this especially challenging for delivering an intervention? Because I imagine we could recruit like caregivers if they are part of like a staff team, but now you have individual units and individual families. And so do you take a special interest to that? And why is it so important to do this with families?
Well, I think that there's sort of a difference between the paid caregiver and the family caregiver. And I think both populations actually need additional resources. And there's some efforts going on to get more resources to the paid caregivers as well. But when it comes to family caregivers, they're, first of all, almost always adult female children who are often, we call them the sandwich generation, because a lot of them are caring for their own children while also managing the care of their adult parent, which really highlights how resource crunched these people are, because whatever precious moments they have are devoted to their own families, to their jobs, to their loved ones, right? There's just so little time. And then a lot of times it's adult, it's the family, it's the partner of the person living with cognitive impairment, and it's almost always women. So we really think of caregiving as a disproportionately female enterprise. And we have to think inclusively about how we get tools and resources to this population. Yeah, and it's hard. It's really hard. Recruiting folks for studies is hard. Recruiting caregivers in particular is an especially unique challenge, because they don't want to do anything added feels burdensome.
That's and understandably so. And the point that you made about family members and the challenges that we face in particular may have to do with the dynamics of family themselves. And that's why it could be important. I imagine, you know, working at a treatment site and we can all go home after a long day at work and face our challenges, but let most of it go. If we're either living with this person or having all these expectations surrounding family and our role and our guilt, I can imagine that also adds a whole another set of items that are burdensome.
Absolutely.
So you're running this study. Who was included in this particular study that you published?
This was a study of family caregivers or informal caregivers. It could have been a friend as well, but it was not paid caregivers of individuals who have a diagnosis of cognitive impairment or dementia. And we were very inclusive with our sampling because we really wanted to reflect the true face of caregiving. We did not have a lot of exclusion criteria, because the main goal of the study was, how do we get tools to people who need them? And I didn't want to pre-specify too much who do I think is the person who might need this tool. But we did want to limit the diagnosis of the care recipient. In this case, we did it to folks with cognitive impairment, because there's some research that suggests that the act of caregiving for folks with cognitive impairment poses additional stressors than, say, caregiving for someone with, a heart illness or lung disease. Just because when folks have cognitive impairment, there's an added layer, like there's some personality changes and role losses or relationship changes that can make things even more challenging for the caregiver, let alone the fact that a lot of times folks with cognitive impairment are not safe to be left alone in a house. So it creates even more hours of caregiving responsibilities for the caregivers too.
Yeah, I could see that. I imagine. So I know the case from someone close to me where even setting up weekly pill schedules, let's say if the person did not have cognitive decline, then they can manage their pill schedules. You could check and you kind of have a feeling everything's good. But in the case where there's cognitive decline or cognitive impairment, you might be in the case where you have to go and recount and find error and use up more time. So the element of the loss of cognitive ability is directly relevant to what the caregiver experiences, right? That they have to double check everything and often have to plan ahead, knowing that the memory is not going to be there about, say, appointments. Whereas if you're dealing with a heart complication, at least that person that you're caregiving for can remind you as the caretaker that we have an appointment today, you could see the burden of attention there.
Right. There's an added layer of caring for someone with cognitive decline. And also because of the progressive nature of the illness, whatever challenges you're experiencing tomorrow, there's the added psychological challenges of knowing that it's going to get worse in the months to come. And so there's a lot of, it's just a lot of additional psychological burdens of caring for someone with a progressive cognitive illness.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so in your study, these were caregivers. They were eligible. As you mentioned, they're self-identified as being an unpaid support person, typically family, could be a friend. And the person that they're looking out for is an older adult and age 65 plus. That was...
Yes.
And it's classic to define that. I think most individuals in reporting older adulthood say use the 65 plus. And then they had cognitive impairment, and you went on and discussed that, but you also indicate that they had been diagnosed by a medical professional in that way. So that was helpful also to know that they had this established diagnosis as well.
Yes.
And so what mobile app program did you use? You decided to go with a mindfulness program, maybe a two-piece question. Why a mindfulness program, and then why a mobile app?
So we chose mindfulness as the intervention. It's probably easier to answer this in tandem. First of all, I'll take this opportunity to plug the Veterans Affairs mental health applications. They have incredible mental health apps that are free for everyone to use. And so we used Mindfulness Coach, which was developed by the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Research at the Veterans Affairs VA, at the VA Palo Alto, but I think they're technically part of the National Center. The app was developed by psychologists and technologists, and it presents a really simple, user-friendly, like not too many bells and whistles approach to a mindfulness protocol that's based off of the VA's mindfulness protocol. So it's not, even though it was developed by the National Center for PTSD, it is not explicitly for PTSD. It's really actually designed for folks who are just naive to mindfulness, and they've gamified it a little bit. So there's levels, and as you go through the app and get farther along in your levels, this little tree starts to grow. And so you kind of get incentivized to keep practicing within the app, because the more you practice, the more your little tree grows, and it's pleasant.
Well, yeah, that's awesome visual feedback too. I like it. I like the symbolism there. And, you know, you're seeing that you're making progress. Yeah.
And, you know, we could have chosen an app with more bells and whistles like Calm or Headspace, some of the more commercialized, popular meditation-based apps. But for this population, we wanted to keep things as simple as possible. We also wanted an app that was free and readily available to the public. And then the other component, which I think is really important, is that the VA wants research partnerships. So they have a research version of the app that was also free for us to use, where we could track all of their in-app use and all of their in-app data. And that really is like a huge component. And why mindfulness? I mean, mindfulness is an evidence-based intervention. It has efficacy in managing anxiety and depression. I think for this particular population, I think it makes a lot of sense to ground people in the present moment. A lot of times caregivers feel like, you know, things are out of control or there's too many things to do, and they need to learn how to like take a beat and stay grounded in the here and now, because if they spiral out into the future, they'll be riddled with anxiety, because the future is scary when you're the caregiver for someone with a progressive illness. And so I thought that the modality of mindfulness in particular would be helpful. I myself am trained as I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I'm trained most extensively in cognitive behavioral therapy, which I also really like and think would be helpful. But a lot of times, you know, when you're a caregiver for someone with a progressive illness, sometimes restructuring catastrophic thoughts might not make the most sense, because sometimes those catastrophic thoughts are realistic in the case of serious illness. And so I thought mindfulness was probably a more inclusive and more readily helpful intervention for this particular population.
And in reading the dialogue that you were having with these individuals under a qualitative interview, it really spoke to what a mindfulness program might do. So I'm looking at quotes in your paper that we often put in qualitative interviews, so you get the gist of what people were saying. And this one female, 68-year-old female, she used the app quite a bit. She said, "I wanted to de-escalate what was happening. So I would try to take myself out of that situation, put on the app to calm me, and then help me calm down and not escalate." I thought this was the important take home for me, not escalate the situation that I didn't have any control over. So we could perhaps, and as you know, caregivers well know, it's like sometimes these things are out of our control. Like we are not going to change this pill count problem, as an example. And we could just make it worse by having dialogue with a person who we know actually isn't going to recover the skill. We can get upset. We could tell them things we just are emotional about. But then coming to this acknowledgement, like, oh, I just don't have control over altering this person's response anymore. And part of what mindfulness does, right, is this objective awareness of seeing thought processes for what they are without reactivity. And once we can perhaps have a moment to sit there and breathe with that experience, we decide not to use that vital energy that we have, that little vital energy we have that discussion with someone, because we know it's not going anywhere anyway. So I enjoyed these quotes that you put in here because it was telling to the intervention you selected. Were there any other dialogues that you recall that struck you the most as, and we don't have to do them in particular here, but just wondering if anything hit a string for you and what these mostly older adults were experiencing as they were caring for others.
Oh gosh, now you're like asking me to pick my darling. Like, which quote was your favorite? You know, I think thematically some of the like we tried to group the interviews into themes. And one of the things that, I guess two of the themes that really resonated for me with this population in particular was the accessibility of the intervention. You know, do I think that this was perfect and everyone's going to completely benefit and do a 180 on their mental health because of it? Like, no, I'm not Pollyanna on this, but enough people appreciated having in the moment additional skills to de-escalate themselves, or to find a moment of calm or a moment of control in a erratic, chaotic environment. And the theme of accessibility really stood out to me of, you know, that they could do something, that they felt like they had a resource that was all theirs, that didn't require anyone else to do anything else, that they could access this moment of calm whenever they needed to, really felt important to me. And then the other thing that I thought felt really relevant and important was this idea of skill transfer. Meaning, you know, my goal when I'm seeing patients is to see them for a short period of time and then for them to go and live their lives with the additional skills and resources that they've gained from therapy. That is my goal as a psychotherapist. I loved seeing that this app, a lot of the users or a lot of the participants in our study reported that at some point they didn't even need to open the app to take a mindful moment or to do some deep breathing or to do a meditation, that just like remembering that it was on their phone was enough to trigger them to engage in a mindfulness practice. And that to me is like the whole point of any therapy is this idea of skill transfer. And I was really encouraged that this mHealth version of mindfulness was able to generate some amount of skill transfer in some amount of our participants.
Yeah, and to speak to your point, I'll pull another quote here, 7-year-old female, even a low app user, so someone who wasn't using it a whole ton, said, I think that taking time again in the practice to center myself, to focus in on my breathing, really helped to reduce stress. It helped to eliminate background noise and background thoughts. It was really a feeling that it was important for me to just take time out for myself, do a check-in. So, I mean, that's probably important for us all. Having an app, if it does chime and remind us, and it does have a message and prompting us, I don't know if this was the case or not, but many of the apps do, it does help with the check-in. Perhaps we are too involved, getting overwhelmed and not even knowing it quite yet, as many of us do, me included. And having something remind us could be good, but that speaks to your point about these effects that go beyond the app and just taking time out. And so you got this information that you're talking about from semi-structured qualitative interviews. So you're sitting down with these folks. Was this by Zoom, by the way? I can't remember if it was interfacing by Zoom or had them come into the clinic.
Oh, it was all virtual.
Virtual.
So some were phone calls, some were Zoom.
Okay, so that's excellent. You can all, if other people wanted to replicate this kind of work, they could by not having to bring as many people into their laboratories. So you talked about six cores, and did you identify one of the things? We don't have to go through all of them. You mentioned one. There were some barriers that do come up. Do you want to speak to some of those barriers? Some you can imagine was just time. I mean, it was convenient, but then there is the time people saying like, well, I don't have any time for myself, so I can't use an app. Any other take home points about understanding the barriers to app use and caregivers?
I think the barriers to app use and caregivers are very similar to app use in the general population too. But, you know, our study did highlight these barriers, which I think are universal to the caregiver population of, you know, time and remembering to do it. And, you know, there's a quote here. Part of what makes it so stressful is that my schedule is so out of control based on the health or lack of health of the person, right? Like these are going to be issues of getting any mental health intervention to this particular population. It's really hard to find something that fits into their daily life. They also, you know, the app was not full of bells and whistles. Some of the participants said that they would have enjoyed having a little bit more variation in the app itself, while others really appreciated the simple design. So, you know, I wouldn't say that the barriers were particularly overwhelming to me. I think what was more impressive was that even these folks who identified the barriers being time, they were still high app users and also appreciated that they could use the app whenever they wanted to. But I've done a lot of mHealth research now, enough to know that most people download an app and never use it again. You know, the median and mode of use for most people is one or zero. So what I was really encouraged by was in the parent study to this article. This article was a secondary analysis of interviews that were conducted as part of a larger study that was a randomized, it was not a randomized control study. I'm sorry. It was a pilot feasibility study. And in that parent pilot feasibility study, people were using the app. The mean and median were like much closer to six or seven uses, which is pretty good. And people use it for an average of about 3.5 hours over the course of the study, I believe. And that's just really encouraging to me that this is a population that with very little additional support, we gave them a 30-minute orientation to how to use the app and why to use the app. So with 30 minutes of a phone-based orientation, they were able to use the app. They wanted to use the app. They did use the app, and they had benefits from it. And that's what, more than the barriers, I think that the encouraging thing here is that this modality and this treatment can be helpful to a very high-risk population.
Yeah, and to get to scale among a group that's hard to recruit and bring into the office, it seems to be a good medium, a good fit. And there were some other improvements just that I came across. It had me thinking about the requests that some had for in-person support. So, and the real person contact they reported. So it's still the human domain is still a challenge, because even though they say I'm too busy, didn't have time to do as much as I wanted to do, but it would still be nice to have a person. How can you maybe have best of both worlds with something like this? Maybe it's a Zoom call. I've done some telephone-based interventions, but what came to mind in working with these folks about what they wanted when they mean real person contact?
I think they want, I mean, we offered them phone-based support in the first 2 weeks to make sure they understood how to use the app. And I think that was really helpful to them. But I could imagine, you know, like phone coaching sessions to help push them towards use as being a really beneficial add-on, or thinking about this as sort of a hybrid intervention where maybe the first one or two sessions are with a social worker or a therapist to help them understand mindfulness and how to use the app. And then, you know, I think mindfulness lends itself really well to app-based learning because it's very self-directed. But I wonder if just having phone-based coaching check-ins would elevate the accessibility of the program.
Yeah, that is a good dynamic. Even sometimes when I'm running studies and we have some caregivers come in with a patient, the caregiver is very interested in being involved, it seems, most of the time. And this is a great way for them also to feel involved in something for themselves. But it could transfer as well to who they're working with. Now, with cognitive decline, I understand that would be a challenge, but maybe just the presence of themselves and how they're acting in response to behaviors of the person they're supporting might be improved. Well, you have this bigger study going on. Do you want to briefly mention the broader study? You said it's a feasibility study. Are those results out? So you got a clinical and translational science center award. This is a KL2. Yeah. And so what happened? What did you find more broadly?
The KL2 closed, and we published the results as well. So we found that the program was feasible and preliminarily efficacious. We had reductions in anxiety symptoms. We had reductions in caregiver burnout. We had really off the charts rates of satisfaction with the app and really high rates of use of the app too, which was excellent and allowed me to leverage those results to get a K-76. So I'm currently in year two of a K-76 grant, which is looking at dyadic mHealth mindfulness therapy. So the same intervention pretty much, but this time we're recruiting patients with serious illness and their caregivers to participate dyadically, which is a recruitment nightmare. So if you're listening to this and you are interested in participating, or you have folks in your network who are interested in participating, please get in touch. But we're really encouraged by the results of the KL2, and our thought was exactly what you said, is if this works well for caregivers, I think this would also work well for folks with serious illness. But more importantly, to do it together and have both a direct and indirect effect, meaning, I joke, the premise of the study was my mother telling as we grew up that she was only as happy as her least happy child. And it's really true, right? Our mental health is really tied to those who we're surrounded by. And so, you know, if the caregiver's anxiety is improving because they're getting this great mindfulness intervention, but the patient's anxiety is through the roof because they're not getting any intervention and they're still very, you know, worked up about what's happening in their lives, the caregiver's anxiety can't get that much better if they're surrounded by the anxiety of their loved ones. There's an interdependence of your moods there. And so our hope is that the intervention will both directly improve each participant and indirectly improve each participant by improving the original partner. So,
well, I love
kind of
your
a
mom's
cool statistical model, but we're excited about the study, even if the recruitment is a nightmare.
Your mom's quote is speaking to me. So we're only as happy as our unhappiest child. So something along those lines. Wow, yeah, that kind of defines my weekend. I'm going to borrow that, if I may, and talk to my wife, because My 5-year-old son was having some pretty big emotions this past weekend.
Our little kids are like emotional terrorists, and yeah, if they're not happy, the whole system is broken. So. Yeah.
Well, and so you answered my final question, which was where you headed, and it sounds like you know where you're headed. You're doing this dyadic program. It's mHealth. You're taking this to the next level. It's slightly a different cohort with who the caregivers are caring for.
Yeah.
But still, the purpose is there, like managing the health of caregivers. And especially maybe we amplify that when we provide it to both the caregiver and the person that they're caring for, when they do have the cognitive ability to do the program.
That's
so
thinking.
Excellent. Congratulations to you. And I wish
you
the best with carrying this forward. We'll conclude for today. Thank you, Dr. Kozlov. It was really nice to get to know you, and I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you.
Listeners can subscribe to the Mindfulness Podcast on Spotify, Audible, or can visit our website at goamra.org. Bye now.